Welcome to Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. Each week, we explore down and dirty ways to stop awfulizing, catastrophizing, going down the rabbit hole, and moving through all the craziness that is happening right now. We're here to create a community of like-minded people as we give you tips, tricks, and techniques for keeping sane in an unhinged world. And now, here are your hosts, Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg.
Greetings, everybody. This is Scott Grossberg, one of your hosts for the podcast, Keeping Your Shit Together in a Stressed World. And I'm here with my co-host, Michelle Post. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Scott. Thanks for tuning in, everybody.
We're laughing. You can probably hear it in our voices because we had a little technical glitch. I mess up some of the intro sometimes.
Rarely.
And so we had to start again.
Usually the edits are my fault.
and I say that to you because here's one of the interesting things that's happened with, and at the beginning of the show, we always talk about stuff. One of the things that I've had an aha moment on is, you know, here I put myself out as the fearless lifestyle coach, and I talk about having, you know, been this little scared kid hiding under the bed and not being, you know, afraid of the dark and clowns stuff like that. And I wouldn't meet people painfully shy. And I had to script my way out of it. And so as a result of that, what I've brought to the table for my clients is, I've been where you're at. I know what you're going through. Let me help you with self-confidence and creativity and love and all the rest of that good stuff. And then this weekend, I had an epiphany.
Oh.
And I began to wonder, and it was a pretty epiphany. Some epiphanies are not so pretty.
Oh, yes.
and it was very interesting because I think at the root of my clients' challenges with self-confidence, including my own, by the way.
Yeah.
It's not self-confidence that's the root of all evil.
Okay.
It's self-worth.
Say what you mean.
And well,
self-worth is deeper, isn't it?
You can only have
self-confidence when you have self-worth.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I started looking at some of the people that I'm working with. And while we talk about, and they're not superficial issues, I mean, these are very big, powerful issues for them, where, you know, they need better self-confidence, they need better creativity, they need better, I just corrected somebody the other day, as a matter of fact, who said, I need more work-life balance. And I said, well, that's great, but I'm not your guy because I don't believe in work-life balance. I believe in work-life harmony.
Oh, yes. I've heard you talk about that.
Mm-hmm. But I don't, it's like there's no way to compartmentalize that for me. Mm. I was always, while I was an attorney, always, quote, accused, end quote, of constantly working. You know, and I've told you guys the story before about being in London in this glorious Queen Victoria room on vacation, and I'm sitting there in bed with my laptop working on a script for somebody who needs it back in LA. And it's like, I literally caught myself and said, what the hell are you doing? you know, it goes back to that wonderful little saying. I know I'm digressing a bit here. I'm not going to let your failure to plan become my emergency.
Yeah.
So I wonder when, and I bring that up, the self-worth concept, because in your therapeutic setting, do you notice that? And I think it's going to tie in somewhat to our discussion today about bickering, because obviously you can't bicker and feel safe without a self-worth component.
You know, I think we probably have to, this is maybe a larger construct that we might need to unpack, because self-worth, I don't know how to, I guess self-worth is tied to what's the word I'm looking for? Like trust in oneself, because I think bickering comes from a trust in oneself, and self-worth is like, I matter. I'm important too. I believe in me, you know? So I guess I haven't thought about these concepts and I'd want to maybe unpack them a little bit. I can see a show here. So I can see, number one, I can see that we need to do an episode on work-life balance versus work-life harmony. I can see that we might need to unpack self-worth versus self-confidence, because I definitely see the tie there. But whether you can bicker in a healthy way without self-worth, that's a good question. It's a really good question.
Well, and let's take it out of the bickering for a minute, and then we'll get into the topic. But in your couples therapy, when you work with couples, presuming for a moment, and I know it's a bigger topic and I know we need to unpack it further, but presuming for a moment that self-worth equals the belief I'm good enough.
Okay.
In a couples therapy setting, do you ever notice that one partner versus another has a greater sense of I'm enough, and the lack of I'm enough by the other partner is what creates some of their, I'll just call it dysfunction. Some of their, you know, I go back to the codependency thing we talked about early on in this podcast, where you're always looking for outside validation. And I wondered this weekend while I had this epiphany, if the lack of self-worth is what causes entertainers and politicians and, you know, these, we're going to have a whole show on narcissism at another time, but these narcissistic personality business types, these influencers, if it's the lack of self-worth that causes folks to look externally for validation.
Oh, yes.
And therefore it's never enough. It's never enough.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The external validation versus the internal validation, right? Internal validation is, I agree with you, self-worth. I am good enough. I can get through this. I support myself. I have a good, strong nurturer voice. Yeah. And I'm glad we separated it from bickering, because in my experience as a therapist, bickering and the ability to stand up for yourself comes from a sense of self-protection. And sometimes the bigger bickerer is the one with the trauma activators who, despite lack of self-worth, will actively argue for themselves because they don't want to be re-traumatized, right? So I have to uncouple self-worth from bickering. But yes, I do see like a really strong push for in my individual clients, in my professional clients, this sense of pushing themselves because I need that external validation. I don't feel good enough, and therefore I need someone else to help me see my value. Yeah. So good stuff. Good stuff you're asking about. So your epiphany was.
It was the self-worth component.
Yeah.
I constantly, when I work with folks, and even in my mastermind group, the pivot play thing that we've talked about, I'm constantly looking for ways to not only innovate, but to help folks instantly, as much as I can use that term, instantly reposition, shift, rewire, reboot themselves in this crazy world we're in. And the changes that the world is going through financially, emotionally, politically, right?
I know.
And it's constant. Nothing's changing. There is not a new normal. I don't know what the fuck normal is anymore. And you know, threats of the bear market, threats of recession, threats of a next election and what that's going to mean.
Threats
of a nuclear war.
We
are starting to doubt more the sources of our information out in the world, because even that has an agenda to it. And so I don't know about the rest of you, by the way, just a little tip. I do not read one source for news. I look at 3, 4, sometimes 5 different sources. And I look at where they have some common thread. I figure that's the news.
Yes. You know, I really love that you're saying this, because my undergrad at UCLA taught me how to be a good researcher. And to be a critical analyst of research. You have to look at who funded the research and is it wonky funding? Like, is it a study about how good grape juice is and it's sponsored by the Grape Juice Society of the world?
Or follow the money.
So follow the money. Number two, was it a blind study, meaning that the researchers had a hypothesis, but somehow they didn't necessarily know which group was assigned to what so that they couldn't skew the data that they're collecting? Was there a good control group that accounts for time, how time over time things change? What else? There's a couple of different ways that you have to look at what you're getting. And the challenge with one source of news is that that news is often being funded by commercials or a news station or, you know, people who want to or don't want to hear the stories that the newscasters or, journalists are reporting. That's why we see journalists really who believe in the freedom of speech and they struggle to get a story out, like the spotlight story about the Bostonian priests and the cover-up from the Catholic Church with children and child molestation. Like, it was a big risk for people to get that news out, or the whistleblower during Watergate, if you go back in time. These were big stories that newscasters had to put their, or journalists had to put their butts on the line to try to get out. And if we're only watching one source, he's kind of out there. And can I even get his name? Is it Noam Chomsky, who was the big linguist, but is very activist? He said, oh, you gotta look at his work. It's amazing. But he said that the most controlled news that he ever went on was actually the more liberal news casts. That he was shocked that he had to speak certain things. He expected it when he went on conservative shows because of their broadcasting, but he didn't expect it when he went on liberal shows like the Associated Press. So anyway, quite interesting, and how we get our news and then figure out whether it's an opinion or it's really research worthy. Is, I agree with you. You got to look at 4 or 5 sources and kind of look at the common thread between them. You know, opinion shows are the worst, I think.
I don't even watch those. I've talked before on their show. We're going to do a whole show, folks, by the way, on gaslighting. And
yes, you know,
and when you watch some of these news sources, it's gaslighting. It just flat out is, right? It They're is. Making you think you're crazy.
Yeah.
If you don't believe their news source. And given my background in litigation and working a lot with politicians and helping some of them form their position statements and discuss, you know, be in the war room with them, you know, I've long believed in the concept of Darvo. We've watched it through the last few elections. It's not isolated to one president, but we've watched it dramatically through some of the last elections. Darvo, if you can't remember this, is deny, attack, and reverse victim and offender. And it's where something is put out, the person who is attacked denies it, then they turn around and attack the other person who's made the accusation, and then the moral high ground gets shifted, and the person who was originally attacked as being the aggressor says, I'm the moral high ground. You need to believe me, folks.
Yeah. Wow, we're in trouble.
By the way, it works. We've watched it in politics here in the US, if not around the world. And it just flat out works. And that's the unfortunate part. So we're going to do a whole show on gaslighting, which is a small component of,
what
we're talking about here. But, it's just been very interesting for me seeing this. Before we jump in the show, anything that you want to talk about?
Well, I had something kind of totally different in my head, but I did want to say, when you mentioned work-life balance versus work-life harmony, an example of work-life harmony where I didn't make someone else's emergency mine was when I was on vacation in Hawaii after my dad died and my mom, we had to move her into assisted living and we had to go through all this like sale of the house and oh, it was wild. But I had forgotten the time change in Hawaii and I had some clients on the East Coast, the Midwest, you know, and Hawaii is quite a bit ahead of the East Coast, 6 hours at sometimes 5 hours at others. And so I accidentally had to get myself up or stay awake till 3 in the morning to see like my early morning clients. And, you know, that was a little bit of a rough day, interrupted sleep, but I really loved it anyway. You know, it was really neat to see a few people that I didn't want to delay seeing me at a, you know, a time I had chosen when I wasn't missing out on other things that other people were going, you know, to do. Nobody was out hiking at 3 a.m. or, you know, fishing or swimming with the turtles or whatever. So sometimes, in fact, I used to describe my perfect day would be like a couple of hours of work and then a couple of hours of play, right? But every day of the week, I find that quite kind of fun to just do a nice mix of some work and some fun on every day of the week, as opposed to really long work days and then recovery days afterwards, which sometimes that's a pattern.
Right. So you're balancing, you're getting the harmony, I should say, rather than compartmentalizing. And, you know, I compartmentalize my work, my exercise, by the way, and I need to blend it more. But it's like, I know Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I'm going to bike. I know Tuesday and Thursday, I'm going to walk. I know exactly how long it's going to be. I know where I'm going to go. And so for me, it becomes these little targets.
Yeah.
That I guess when I look at it overall, it becomes a harmony, but it's still like, it's still separate in my head. It's okay. There's the rest of life and you got to work out.
Well, okay. So we have a couple of shows to talk about in the future that I'm looking forward to. Gaslighting.
So let's talk about bickering.
Okay.
What do you have a definition you like of bickering? Because I, you know, in preparation for the show, looked up a number of different ones, but
No, I don't think I've ever stopped to define it. I think it's like that old Larry Flint porno quote. You can't really define pornography, but you know it when you see it.
Oh, you know what? Oh, wait. I'm going to push back. Let me bicker with you for a minute.
Yes. Was it not Larry Flint?
Which, by the way, it was not Larry Flint. This is not bickering, by the way. Okay. Bickering, just so that we know, at least the way I'm going to use it today, is arguing about unimportant things.
Okay.
Petty things, trivial things.
Okay.
But the quote you gave is actually the United States Supreme Court.
Oh, oops. I'm so close to knowing things.
but you kind of got it in the context. The United States Supreme Court, while they were reviewing some First Amendment issues about pornography, they were trying to say what pornography is, right? You can't issue a rule about something if you can't define it.
Right.
And even the Supreme Court said, when it comes to pornography, we don't know what it is, but we know it when we see it.
So I know what bickering is when I see it, but I love your definition. You defined it as arguing about unimportant things.
Yeah. It's like
the minor stuff.
I will tell you why this came up. I'll just give the listeners some quick background.
Okay.
Some friends of ours had come over to pick up some furniture we were storing for them. And I won't go into why. We were storing some furniture for some friends of ours. And they came from out of state finally to pick this up so that we could clear out part of our garage. And I'm watching them and they're just like back and forth with each other.
Yes. Yes. I have been there.
Over fucking nothing.
Yes.
But it's like a jab here, a poke there, a little snarl seriously. Here, a snit there. And it's like, and then they just kind of went on. It was like Teflon, all of these things back and forth to each other. They were used to it, I'm presuming, because we haven't been around them for a while.
Yes.
But that's bickering to me. It wasn't about anything important. It wasn't about anything that would change anybody's life. The world did not shift on its axis. And, you know, the sun did not blot out anybody's eyes because they said anything awe-shattering, right? Or soul-shattering. Mm-hmm. It was just little shit. It was... You know how many times you're late? Do you know how many times you don't do this? Do you know how many times, blah, 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 blah. What are we going to do with this? Where are we going to put it? You really wanted to save this? And the beauty of it, and this is where I was fascinated, neither one of them took the bait.
Okay.
It was just part of the relationship.
Okay.
And I want to also emphasize it wasn't constant like I just did it. It was just periodically this little... thing got thrown out periodically, and it was him, and sometimes it was her, and it was sporadic. It wasn't, again, I gave you a barrage of stuff. It wasn't done like that. It was like just throughout the time we were with them, periodically one of them would throw this little barb out and the other one would go, oh yeah, yeah, got it. It's like they're, well, somebody's pitching, the other one's catching. And then they throw the ball, and then they throw the ball back.
Oh my goodness. And I have witnessed this behavior. Yes. And it does throw you off, right? Like, how has this couple been together so long when they bicker all the time? Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, my wife and I don't bicker. I just
Ryan and I don't either.
which got me then to thinking, is it normal, number one, to bicker? And number two, is it healthy in a relationship to bicker?
Right. So that's a really good question. And I'm sure that you probably looked it up. I can tell you that when I was preparing for this, I was thinking about bickering as a cute way of describing arguing. And when I was thinking about the health of a relationship, arguments are definitely healthy and a good part of a healthy relationship. But pulling from John Gottman's research on couples out of Seattle, I would say that if the bickering is 1 to every 6 times of positive, then you're working on the right balance in the brain and the brain chemistry and the health of a relationship. So healthy couples can bicker, healthy couples can argue. I wonder about the chronic bickering that is not balanced with the positive fun, filling up your cup, romance, sex, et cetera. Right. But what did you find in your research for today?
Well, it's actually very similar to what you were talking about. In fact, the sources that I looked at, and these range from the New York Times to some medical studies, but that bickering, and again, I'm using it in the context of bringing up unimportant shit and you guys argue about it, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So that's bickering the way I'm using it, that it's actually part of a healthy relationship. And I'm going to go as far as, although I didn't see any article or study talk about it, I want everybody to think about, have you ever watched a couple newly in love?
Yes.
Just at that.
Yeah.
And they're like,
everything smells good.
No. But have you ever noticed that one will hit the other or poke the other?
Yeah. Like there's like playful touch.
Well, it's playful hitting. It's not touch. It's not, and I'm not talking about, I'm not talking about that kind of thing. I'm talking about you've seen it. The wife or the husband will poke somebody in the arm, or they'll hit somebody with their elbow. There's a very physical aggression. This part of this playful dating. I don't know how else to describe it. This stuff that goes on.
Is this healthy? Of
love. Well, I think actually that is. And I think it's, I've studied body language for quite some time along with, other things, and that physicality. Yeah. Again, presuming it's not abusive, presuming it's not hurtful, presuming it's not excessive, right?
Yeah.
And it's a permission kind of thing. You okay. know that it's going to happen. We're not talking about bullying. We're not talking about anything onerous. We're not talking about a battered wife syndrome or a battered husband syndrome. We're talking about this playful pushback about nothing. I almost wanted to make okay. a Seinfeld joke, right? Our Seinfeld.
Yeah, yeah.
When you watch them, they bickered. It was a show about nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And yet this is like what seems like a healthy couple in your life, and they have been together for a while, and you know, no red flags popped up.
Well, and yeah, and the interesting part of the studies that I looked at,
okay.
the articles and discussions, was the concept, and I'm not there yet, I'm not a professional on it, so I can't say this, but the concept they put forward that uh-huh. bickering actually promotes honesty in a relationship. And oh. one of the things I'm looking at right now is that a benefit, I'm reading you one of the quotes, this is from marriage.com. Another benefit of a bickering marriage is that it leaves room for honesty. Bickering, by definition, emphasizes petty fights, which in turn removes pretense. So, as they put it, when couples bicker, they become vulnerable, and then they let it all out. You can tell your partner what they did, how it affects you, and then you banter back and forth on it. And so this got me to thinking, do a lot of our listeners, and this is more rhetorical than anything else right now, I think a lot of our listeners, but I wonder if a lot of our listeners bicker with life. Do you catch yourself? Are you, and I'm going to take it out of the context of constant complaining, but do you find yourself nitpicking shit?
Yeah, about life. Yeah. That's a really good question. And then no one's there to argue back, right? So what do you do with that?
That becomes a whole nother issue. Right? That's when they need you. or someone shows up in their imagination and starts to bicker back.
It's a little scary.
The interesting part to me about the bickering concept is the underlying premise that by feeling free enough to bicker with a partner back and forth, you pitch, they catch, they pitch, you catch, mm-hmm. is that it builds trust.
Okay.
And so that kind of ties in with the self-worth that we had chatted about at the beginning, where I said, you know, if you are enough and you trust that, and it's internal, then can someone's external bitching mm-hmm. about anything unimportant really matter?
No, if you're the Buddhist at work, or, you know, if you're the Buddha, not the Buddhist, but if you are the Buddha at work in your relationships and your friendships, you are a little like Teflon, right? You are unattached to, you're observant and present and unattached to someone's, I guess, Freudian projections, we would call it. And you know, you are responsible for your reactions to things. That would be kind of the Buddha psychology approach, is nobody can make you feel anything.
Which, by the way, at least in the Western world, is so counterintuitive to the way most of us were raised.
Oh, I know. I mean, like, it's really hard to help a couple find different language than "you made me feel something." Like, you are giving away all your power in that statement. It's not accurate, because you may have patterns of reacting to things that have nothing to do with the fact that your partner just did it. You know, so that is much more about you and your history. You make you feel however you feel. Now, other people's behavior can sometimes suck, and you don't enjoy it, and it does activate your old patterns, but ultimately you are responsible for how you feel and how you act.
So not how another do you human. So how do you, in a couples therapy setting, with uh-huh. the understanding you can't give therapy to everybody here,
right,
nor would
right.
we want you to, right? This is not what that's meant to be.
That would be very blind. I have no idea who's listening.
I'm looking at the distinct difference between what we're talking about for bickering, again, arguing about things that are unimportant, versus a couple, and they're just placing blame and shame and insults are flying.
Right, right.
And so in a, and maybe I'm asking an unfair question of you, how do you, in a very general sense, how do you handle something like that when you see a couple that are not bickering? They're actually they're actually going after each other. How do you de-escalate something like that?
Well, we have to unpack whatever the problem is, right? But de-escalation is the same whether I'm dealing with an individual or a couple or a family or organization or work partners. De-escalation is all about knowing brain chemistry and calming down the limbic system and the amygdala and, you know, the fight or flight system and getting someone back to their prefrontal cortex being back online and being rational. When we're really emotional, we're in our mammal brain. We are not thinking clearly. Our prefrontal cortex that's responsible for decision-making is offline and it is fight, which can be verbal fighting or aggressive physical fighting, flee, which is running away or emotionally stonewalling and completely cutting off contact with another person, like they're not there, you're not listening. Freeze, which is just your body is in total shock and you might not even be absorbing anything that you're going through, fight, flight, or freeze. So we got to get the animal brain back under control through breath work. Sometimes I teach my couples this finger push-up thing that I call, like where you're stimulating both sides of the brain by just kind of having your hands in prayer position, but then pulling your palm away so that just your fingertips are touching. Then you move your fingertips out into an oval shape. This is really hard to do on verbal, into an oval shape, and then you push them back in to a prayer kind of pose. And as you breathe in and out, you kind of are slowing down the reaction in the body. So that's one example. Sometimes just taking a deep, slow belly breath is a simple example. We've taught the box breathing, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold for four, exhale for four, hold for four, as if you're creating like a little box in your mind of a count of four. So sometimes it's like we do a little laughing yoga to like get the body back into a more positive brain chemistry space. So we got to get all the dysregulation calmed down. And then people can talk more rationally and they can hear better. When you are in fight zone, you can't hear the other person's perspective. You've got to win because somehow your life depends on it in some case. So that's why the bickering question really threw me off, because I can't imagine that the problem with constant bickering, while it can lead to discussions without pretense, is people cross the, can I say that F word?
People I did.
Cross the fucking line. So if you're joking or teasing or sarcastic, like those are all forms of criticism criticism or contempt that you have for another person, but you're using like jokey little jabs at somebody and you never know when you're going to hit their ouch button. And now you've got a real, argument where you're debating in a healthy way, but you've got a real argument where someone's feelings are hurt or they're angry.
And that brings up one of the biggest components that at least the common theme that I found while I was preparing for this show, and that's that bickering, as we've defined it, should word.
You're shitting on yourself.
We're going to should all over everybody, right? It shouldn't ruin your whole day.
Yeah, it shouldn't, but that's the challenge with like bickering in that way, jabbing at each other.
The question then becomes, and again, some of this is subjective on the part of the listener, the person receiving this, is it really bickering? Remember, I've predefined this as bickering about unimportant things.
Right.
If it's important, then by definition, it's not bickering anymore. Now you're being attacked or you're attacking.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I looked up were, again, some common threads of things that listeners can do when they find themselves, either they start the bickering or they're the subject of bickering.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
again, given the understanding, I'm using these friends of ours as a model here, because I'm watching them, and these little tiny periodic, sporadic, inconsistent jabs.
Yes.
It was like nothing.
Yeah.
It was odd to me, and that's why I noticed it.
Yeah.
But for them, again, these weren't constant. It wasn't a barrage. It wasn't belittling. Uh-huh. It was just this. And they just let it go. It rolled off their back like water off the back of a duck.
That for those is of you shocking. That might
remember that.
Uh-huh. That's shocking. Because I've been around a couple that's bickered and watched it escalate. And like, this is like a new couple in our lives. And I've watched it kind of escalate. And I'm like, oh, okay. And they've been together since they were teenagers. And my parents were together since they were teenagers and bickered a lot. So I almost wonder if it, like, how long this couple you were witnessing have been together. But there's something
they have about been. They have been together since high school. They were high school sweethearts.
I think we found a common thread. So high school sweethearts in all three couples, my parents, this other couple I know, this couple you know, and they bickered almost like teenagers, like bickering, like as if they were stuck there in, because Brian and I, right, we met later in life when I worked out all that. I worked through almost all my shit.
It's interesting that you say that, because I never noticed that common pattern. That could very well be it. I went through and said, okay.
Bicker at each other, right? Like, that's a common teenage thing. Me. You know?
Yeah. And again, some of this comes down to, I found three things that seem to be, again, common across the board for people who find themselves engaged in bickering in their relationships.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be a lover or a sensual partner. This could be your friends, like, right?
Your friends.
This could be online. Or,
sure.
Don't be a troll, by the way. don't use this for evil. Number one, it's being aware of the person you're talking to and their needs.
Yeah.
We've talked before about the love language test.
Yep.
And, you know, that's only one. There are people, by the way, who can take that love language test and it doesn't apply to any of them. So I don't want everybody to think that's the only way to do it.
Sure.
Be aware of your partner's needs. And one of the things I like to do with folks is to suggest, this will change everybody's lives that's listening.
Oh.
Go to your relationship and take some quiet time with your partner and ask them, what's important for you in a relationship?
And then
listen, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a question you throw out and then you move on and you answer it. What's important for you in a relationship? Because here's what's important for me, blah, 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 blah. what's important in a relationship? And then listen to them. They will clearly tell you the languages that they use and what the buttons are and things.
Yeah.
And then they ask you that question.
Yes.
Right. What's important for you in the relationship? And then you answer those. And then wouldn't life be wonderful if you could each do what the other said?
Yes. Yes. Easier said than done.
And that, by the way, is a way for you to be aware of. You don't have to like it. You don't have to embrace it. You don't have to adapt it or adopt it.
Mm-hmm.
This is obviously a relationship that's important for you.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this discussion.
Right.
Because it wouldn't matter at that. Right.
Right.
And it's a wonderful way for you to ask a very open-ended question.
Okay.
That helps you get metrics, data, and be aware of what your partner is saying.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, and we've talked about this before, particularly when it comes to cognitive distortions and logical fallacies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to use the F word now. Don't be a fucking mind reader.
I know.
I mean, we've talked about, I play one on TV, but it's not something that you can do in real life. And when we make those assumptions, and we know what an assumption is made out of, when you make those assumptions, I can tell you that a lot of times you'll be wrong, but you'll continue. you'll continue to argue, bicker, et cetera, based on what you've in your little brain. We did a show on confabulation, you know, what you and your little brain have said. Well, they said A, they then said D. I know they have to have been thinking B and C to get A and D to connect together.
Yes.
And you're wrong. So here's a little tip.
Okay.
I'm going to be very zen-like with you now.
Oh, I like it. Okay.
One question is worth 1,000 speculations.
Yes. Yes.
Just freaking ask.
If you actually listen to the answer.
Well, yeah, that this presumes active listening.
Active listening, yes.
And that you care. Yeah. You know, I got to tell you, it's not what we were going to talk about today, but it's important. I've had a number of people recently have rediscovered this. These books aren't new. Have rediscovered the how not to give a fuck, how to be this and don't give a fuck.
Oh, yeah.
And how not to. And it's like, I'm listening to them and that seems to be the answers now. They've adopted this. I just don't give a fuck.
Yes.
And it's like, at number one, that's not true, or you wouldn't be having the conversation.
Right.
And number two, how disingenuous and dismissive. When you know, if I'm saying something to you and you say back to me, I don't give a fuck. It's like, huh?
Yeah, I agree. Like, it feels like, what, do you not care about me? Because this matters to me.
Yeah, right? So
I'm sharing it with you.
So I'm going to add the word playful to the toolkit for people.
Okay.
And that is, if you are playfully bickering, I think it can be healthy.
I agree. You be aware of that damn line. I guess you might cross it.
And that then brings the third little tip here. When things seem to be getting out of control.
Yes.
Use a safe word.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have a safe word for your discussions.
Yeah.
I need this. I need that. Or alternatively, have an agreement ahead of time. I'm a big believer in scripting some of this stuff, despite the fact that it seems impulsive and or, you know, it's not natural, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you just want to have this discussion. You don't want it scripted ahead of time. At least be able to say, I need you to, you've heard Michelle do this with me. I need you to unpack that.
Yeah, I do.
What do you mean by that? When you say this, what does that mean?
Right. Or in an argument setting, when my feelings have become hurt or I'm stressed or scared, I will do my best to communicate and narrate past trauma and say, ouch, wow, hold just a second. I need to take a breath. Can we take a pause? And whoever initiates the pause or the break to go re-regulate is the person that gives also a time frame and then comes back and either asks for more time or re-engages. You don't want to abandon your work partner or your life partner in the middle of their passionate discussion, but you might need to re-regulate so you don't lose your temper, or you don't start crying, or you don't start having a panic attack, or all these kinds of things.
And by the way, when listeners, again, my two cents, when listeners find themselves triggered like that, I'm gonna invite you to go back to something that one of my mentors, somebody, unfortunately, he's passed away now. But you've heard me chat about him with the concept of Ho'oponopono. Mm-hmm. And that's psychologist, by the way, Dr. E. Haleakala Hulin. And he was a big believer that when you have things like that that trigger you, what's happening is you're remembering a memory.
Yes.
And it's a self-perpetuating thing, right? Your memory is not correct. So when you find yourself being triggered, at least understand it's a lie.
Yeah. You got to get yourself out of that story. So again, you've got to go back, re-regulate your physiology so you can bring your prefrontal cortex back online and communicate clearly. So quick tips, count backwards from 100 by 3, look around the room, name 5 things green, take deep belly breaths. If you need more time, take a healthy time out from the argument. Just if it's a work relationship, you might not be able to say, I'm feeling dysregulated and I need to go and do some breathing. But you can say, I have an appointment coming up that I need to prepare with. This is a really important discussion. Let me get back to you. So they don't have to know what your appointment is. Your appointment is go to your fucking office and breathe so you can come back into the conversation and think clearly, right? But still make sure you come back to the conversation when you're re-regulated.
So I'm going to add one thing here because I wasn't going to go here today, but okay. I was going to save it for next week. But because you said that,
okay,
you know, in hypnosis, one of the first things I learned in getting my hypnotherapy certification was something called a pattern interrupt.
Uh-huh.
And that's where, you know, there are handshake interrupts, for example, where you go out and you go to shake somebody's hand, they reach out to shake your hand and they go on autopilot. You can watch it in their eyes. You shake hands, they're on autopilot, and then you don't shake their hand. Instead, you reach out with your other hand and grab their arm, or you take the top of their hand, you move your hand around, take the top of their hand and drop their hand down. And you can watch it in their eyes, the eye processing cues. This autopilot computer goes, what the fuck? And right at that moment, you can do what you need to do with it. By the way, if you've ever watched any good politicians, uh-huh. I won't name any of them. Some of the good politicians, watch uh-huh. what happens when they shake hands. They will reach out with their other hand and yeah. touch people. It becomes yeah. a pattern interrupt.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we're chatting about here that I think you've mentioned, Michelle, that I'm just going to say it, is use some levity and or some languaging pattern interrupts to kind of lighten things up. And one of the things I read yesterday, I haven't used it yet. I'm just going to let you guys know I have not used this yet.
Okay.
But I love it.
Okay.
And that is to add the words "for secret reasons" after you say something. and one of the things, the friend of mine who wrote this is actually a comedian, and he's okay. a screenwriter and producer, and it was hilarious. And here's the example he gave. It's not mine, it's his. I can't wait to try it out on my wife. Honey, I can't take the trash out for secret reasons. Now, look at us laughing right now. Look at us laughing right now. If you just, at the right time, you don't want to use it all the time, but at the right time, can you imagine just saying, I hear what you're saying, and I'm not going to do that for secret reasons.
I absolutely think it would be hysterical. If you can
find things like that, mm-hmm. I think it will help again with the pattern interrupts and help you add some levity so that you bring the heaviness of the discussion down.
I do too.
Which leads us into what we're going to do next week. And okay. we're going to take this discussion and we're going to add some steroid mix to it, some brew. And we're gonna have a discussion entitled "How to Let Your Partner Be Right," said no one ever. And this all came about because Michelle and I were actually talking about Love Story, the movie.
Yeah.
And I don't know many of you that might remember the tagline: "Love means never having to say you're sorry." I
hate that tagline.
Well, big movie. Big tagline. I think everybody, at least our age, inherently, they've heard that one.
Yeah.
Love means never having to say you're sorry.
A lot of divorces.
And so we're going to have a discussion about how to let your partner be right.
Yeah. This is a totally different subject, but there's a lot of weird training out there. Like people who never say, I love you. And like, oh, you just show it? Like that. It's important to hear it too. These are really important things that we're saying, like
yeah.
how to say, I'm sorry, how to let a partner be right. You know, how to say, I love you. And, you know, you have to shift it a little bit for your working relationships and your friendships, but it's important there too, you know, just to develop that healthy, holistic.
You know, I, again, we don't usually talk about it, but when I do my customer care training, we'll call it,
yeah.
with government entities. Believe it or not, there is such training out there, folks.
That it's awesome.
They don't implement it a lot of time. But I'm out there giving it to them, from elected officials down to, the help desk. And one of the things I'm telling them, among other things, is that when you're on the phone or when you're talking to somebody, to smile internally. Yes. And internally, you don't say it externally. Internally, literally say, "I love you."
Yeah, to the person on the other end.
And they look back at me as like, "Are you out of your mind? In a work environment, you want me to love them?" I was like, "Yeah, I do."
Yes, it actually is true. I think I'm so glad you mentioned this, because this is for any of you that are caregivers or coaches or healthcare workers or therapists. I work to find something about my client that I like or I love, and it makes me a better person. I don't tell them I love you, but I really do develop that caring feeling for the people I'm working with.
It's internal. This is internal.
It's all scripted. Internal. It's all internal, because if I can't, I really don't do good work. I really don't do good work. So
I think that's important.
Yeah. So I hope that helps those of you. I think it's been an interesting discussion. It went in a totally different direction than I expected, but I hope it's helpful for those of you out there that tuned in for this, how bickering could save your relationships.
All right. Yeah. So in conclusion, what I would love, I'm gonna make a big ask of everybody. We've said it in passing before. I'm going to make a big ask of everybody today. And I don't want any argument about it. I really, Michelle and I really put a lot into this show, and I really would appreciate if all of you listening, if you're getting something out of this, if you're listening to it, you are, do us a favor, like, subscribe, and share this podcast with others. It helps us to continue with the move forward, to let us know that what we're doing matters. We know it matters, or we wouldn't be doing it. Michelle and I've joked before, we would be doing this even if it wasn't in a podcast format, because it stimulates us and it helps us to grow and adventure as well through these crazy times.
Yeah.
But you guys can help us too. So please like, share, subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And with that, until next time, you have anything to add, Michelle?
I would just say, despite our really good internal validation, I echo what Scott says. We could really use a little external validation with your likes and your shares and your subscribes.
There you go. All right. Until next time. Thank you all for listening. Peace. Bye-bye. Peace.
You've reached the end of another episode of Keeping Your Together in a Stressed World with Michelle Post and Scott Grossberg. If you like our show, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate our broadcast, and leave a review. The podcast is for general information only and not intended to be legal or mental health advice, nor the formation of a lawyer-client, nor therapist-patient relationship. Stay tuned for our next episode, and thank you for listening.